From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, When I Was Cool, Life at the Jack Kerouac School. As a teenager, Sam Kashner was intoxicated by the beat writers, including Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, and William Burroughs. When he saw a brochure, he enrolled at the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics. But his heroes were no longer young men. They were long in the tooth and cranky. Kashner's memoir about his beat school years is now out in paperback. Also, food writer Ruth Reichel tells us about a time in her life when she disguised herself as an aging hippie redhead one night and a blonde divorcee the next. And film critic David Edelstein reviews the new French film, Kings and Queen. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Studying with Allen Ginsberg, William Burroughs, and Gregory Corso sounds like it would have been the hippest education imaginable for a college student who devoured beat literature. Let's just say the reality wasn't quite what Sam Kashner expected when he left his parents' house in Long Island in 1976 to enroll at the new Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics. Located outside Boulder, Colorado, the school basically was the English department of Naropa University, which was established by a Tibetan Buddhist meditation teacher. In his memoir, When I Was Cool, Kashner writes about getting close to the beat writers who had been his heroes. Kashner also is the author of Sinatra Land and is a frequent contributor to Vanity Fair and GQ. When I Was Cool has just been released in paperback. Terry spoke with Sam Kashner last year when the book first was published. Here's a short reading from the beginning of When I Was Cool.
What I didn't quite realize as I packed my bags for the Kerouac School was that Ginsberg, Burroughs, and the rest of the Beats were on the downward slope of their fame. 11 years earlier, Allen had been crowned King of the May in Czechoslovakia. William Burroughs' Naked Lunch, considered a classic novel of nightmare comedy, was nearly 20 years old. Because the core faculty had turned their autobiography into art, their fictional selves lived on in a kind of perpetual youth. But, as I would soon discover, they themselves had grown old. The Beats I would encounter at Naropa were long in the tooth, cranky, full of bowel complaints, and the perils of advanced age. I came downstairs. My parents had a present for me, waiting for me in the car. It was my father, Seymour Kashner. He would be coming with me to Boulder to see that I got settled in okay. My father going with me to the Jack Kerouac School? In the midst of my happiness, another crisis. I felt the cold hand of embarrassment on my shoulder. Just for the weekend, my mother said. With so many secret fears of what life among the Beats would be like, I was secretly relieved. I'd have my naked brunch at last. But it would be with my father at the other end of the table, eating Baskin-Robbins.
That's Sam Kashner reading from his new book, When I Was Cool, My Life at the Jack Kerouac School. As we can see in the reading that you just did, you were intoxicated by the young Beats who were on the road and who were writing their classic fiction. You weren't prepared for the older versions of them that you encountered when you went to Naropa. How had Ginsberg changed with age from the image that you had in your mind?
Well, the Allen Ginsberg that I came to Naropa expecting to find was very, very different. I wanted the, or thought I had wanted, the outrageous beatnik, the, as Gregory Corso once called them, the commie, sex-crazed, stoned beatniks of the 50s and of legend. And instead, I found someone who had almost institutionalized his legend, who was looking for a way somehow to kind of hang up his beat sneakers and somehow come in off the road. Someone who was, to some degree, I don't want to say trading on his reputation, but who was beginning to sort of codify his fame and his reputation and to somehow lean on the legend. I found someone who was a copious keeper of files. I mean, down to the files. He kept files on the pets of his friends: Gregory's cat, Bill's hound dog. I mean, they all had their own files, and with Bill Burroughs, the same thing. I thought I would be encountering this great sort of junkie of legend, and instead I got someone who was walking with a cane. So it was a real cold bath for me. I expected a much different kind of crew.
How did you first find out about Naropa and the Jack Kerouac School?
I saw a copy of possibly the only copy extant of the catalog for the Jack Kerouac School.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at it, and it had a picture of Allen Ginsberg and Bill Burroughs and Gregory Corso on a park bench, and this was the core faculty, and I just fell in love. I felt I had to go there. I had to be there. And it was like, you know, it was like being a painter and being able to sort of, you know, study with at a school with the great masters, you know. I just saw myself as the fourth man on the bench, you know. I didn't realize at the time there was no room on that bench for a fourth person, you know, even if you weighed 98 pounds.
Would you describe your first meeting with Allen Ginsberg when you got to the Kerouac School?
Sure. It was in Boulder, and I went into sort of a student-teacher apartment complex that the Jack Kerouac School had reserved for what I thought was the school, which turned out to be Allen, Bill Burroughs, Gregory Corso, Anne, and myself as a student. And I saw Allen, but he was practically undressed. I mean, he was wearing boxer shorts, and he might have been wearing socks. And he was very comfortable in his own house and sitting at a large, in his breakfast nook, which was really just a glass table with a couple of kind of overwrought iron chairs, as as Bill Burroughs called them, you know. And he didn't have his beard, which just completely threw me. And with that slightly kind of charming but crooked mouth of his, he just didn't look like Allen Ginsberg. He looked like an eighth-grade science teacher.
One of the reasons why you went to Naropa as opposed to a conventional college was that you didn't want to deal with shared toilets in a dormitory. What was your problem with that?
Well, I was just kind of particular. And, okay. You know, I'm sort of a throwback. I'm like Oscar Levant when it comes to, you know, personal hygiene. And so that was a real obstacle for me, going to a conventional college. I tried it. I tried going to Hamilton College in Clinton, New York, when it was an all-boys school. And I certainly wasn't prepared for beet hygiene, which
I can imagine. I was thinking, like, how could somebody so obsessive about personal hygiene even think about being part of beet culture?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that was another revelation, really. I mean, but I did have my own plays, and Peter Orlovsky, Allen's lover and companion of more than a quarter of a century, was a fantastic housekeeper, you know. But but really, it was difficult. But I also, in a way, was completely unschooled, even in taking care of myself. When Allen would give me his laundry to do, I went through a brief period where I was sending it home to my mother.
You're kidding.
No, absolutely. In giant sort of UPS boxes. And this poor, lovely woman out in Merrick, Long Island, was having to do Allen Ginsberg's laundry, you know. I mean,
why didn't you do it yourself?
I probably just didn't want to touch it, you know. I didn't, you know, I had to do it. I could have actually taken it to a laundry.
I was going to mention that next.
Yeah, I know, Terry. Yeah. But it was, you know, I was kind of so sheltered that I was almost only related to my parents in some way. I was like a kind of feral child in that way. You know, I mean, I didn't do it for the entire 2 years, but I realized when I was doing it how absurd it was and what an imposition. And also, Allen was grumpy about why he wasn't getting his laundry back fast
enough. So he didn't know.
No, God, no. I never told him either.
Sam Kashner speaking to Terry Gross in 2004. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2004 interview with Sam Kashner, who studied with beat poets Allen Ginsberg, Gregory Corso, and William Burroughs.
Part of your job, in addition to being Allen Ginsberg's apprentice was to take care of Allen Ginsberg's people, to take care of his longtime lover Peter Orlovsky, to take care of the fallen poet Gregory Corso, to take care of William Burroughs' son, who was an alcoholic who was suffering with cirrhosis of the liver. How did you feel about being handed these responsibilities for broken people?
Well, at the time, I'd romanticized the Beats so much that it really took years and the writing of this book, essentially, to kind of understand how broken or lost they were. At the time, I was just sort of treading water, trying to kind of stay up. I was really just trying to deal with one incredible crisis after another and keep what I thought was my cool, you know, literally and figuratively. I would lurch from crisis to crisis with Gregory, for example, who was much more of a serious junkie than William Burroughs, another sort of revelation. And then there was Peter's confession that he, after 25 years with Alan, was in fact felt that it was just the power of Ginsberg's personality that had sort of overwhelmed Peter, and that what in fact he really wanted to do was to live with a woman and have a baby. I mean, these were a lot of things to sort of lay at the doorstep of a pretty unformed teenage kid from Long Island.
In the passage that you read for us, you write about what it was like to encounter Ginsberg and Burroughs when they were older men, as opposed to being the younger men of their early, now classic literature. And you wrote that they were long in the tooth, cranky, full of bowel complaints and the perils of advanced age. How did they deal with those perils of advanced age? Would they sit around and complain a lot about their bowel disorders and about, you know, all the problems that they were having related to their aging?
Yeah, I mean, Alan and Burroughs in particular, after a lifetime of junk, to his horror, Bill Burroughs realized that he was dealing with constipation. You know, he said had he known how constipated he would have become as an old man, he would never have gotten involved with heroin. So
they don't tell you that when you're young.
No, they don't. It's not a shame. And
can you imagine the public service ads for that?
Yeah, that's right. That'd be great. Yeah. So Burroughs was obsessed with his bowels. Gregory, who was only in his 40s when I knew him, constantly referred to himself as a toothless old man, as a kind of medieval hag. He looked like that in a way. I mean, he really did look like he had just stepped out of a Bruegel painting with no upper teeth and this kind of wild hair. And I mean, some of it was just financial. I don't think he could afford dentures. And Alan too was a kind of biddy about sort of taking his medicines at the right time and whether the tea was too hot or the tea was too cold. I mean, he was a magnificent complainer.
Yes, you call him the whiner who howled.
The whiner who howled, yeah. Yeah. Although, you know, I was a little ashamed to write that when, you know, you realize how bravely and magnificently he handled his own death.
I'll just say something about my relationship to Allen Ginsberg fan and sometime interviewer, which is that, you know, I'd see him and I would just be in awe of some of his performances and of some of the things that he'd have to say about life. And then one time I'd interview him and he would just kind of gas on and it was hardly usable because it was just so, like, overly wordy and speedy and not really saying much of anything. And then I would talk to him another time and I would just be amazed at how insightful and interesting and full of feeling his conversation was and his writing. Right. And he just seemed to, in that sense, kind of embody both. And it was always worth hanging in there because, like, the wonderful Ginsberg was so wonderful and so and so unique.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, there was something also, do you think, almost kind of rabbinical quality.
Absolutely,
about his genuine sort of joy in life, his wisdom, you know, his very keen, almost Proustian sense of observable detail, which I think he, you know, I guess he and Kerouac sort of shared that, the idea that, you know, the kind of shapeliness of mind, how you would sort of write as you think, that somehow your writing should resemble a kind of natural shapeliness of the mind. But, you know, if you talk, it was my impression, even back then, that if you talked about that kind of thing for too long,
mm-hmm.
you can just, I mean, it's like ether. You just would put the room to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And also people with butterfly nets would start to chase you, you know. I mean, there's just there's a certain amount of that one can take, and then you really do lose your audience, you know.
Now, Allen Ginsberg was gay, and you write in your book that you write, I wanted Allen to love me without taking me to bed. Did you feel it was hard for him to love you without taking you to bed?
Oh, gosh. That's such a good question. And I wonder. I mean, I always thought that the really good-looking guys later, when there were more students that had come to the Kerouac School, when I sort of survived my apprenticeship and made the world safe for the Kerouac School, for other students to come to the Kerouac School, I think that I noticed that if you were really good-looking, Allen really liked your poems and kind of championed you. And so I spent a lot of time kind of getting dressed and groomed and ready for my classes with him, you know, and my one-on-one poetry workshops, because I wanted him to like my poems, and also I wanted him to sort of fall in love with me. I mean, I felt like, in a way, a great lineage would be falling in love with me at the same time, you know, that I'd be sitting on, it was like sitting on Walt, on Whitman's lap, you know, on Uncle Walt's lap. So I did want him to love me, but I wanted him to love my work and love the enthusiasm that I brought to my job as a kind of sorcerer's apprentice, you know. But because we didn't sleep together and it wasn't a sexual relationship, I'll always wonder about that. I mean, I think that if, in a way, I wondered if the relationship suffered because that didn't happen. But there's no way of knowing that now.
There was a meal that brought your two worlds together when your parents took you and Ginsberg and Peter Orlovsky to a deli. What was it like to have those two worlds come together?
Well, it was two things. It was kind of a nadir and a sort of summit all at the same time. I mean, it was a nadir of embarrassment. My mother and father meeting Allen Ginsberg and Peter Orlovsky, and yet the fact that they were in my company and in my parents' car was just an almost unbelievable joy. A kind of great triumph. But then, of course, you know, the worlds collided when it was someone's idea, I think possibly my mother's, that we all looked sort of undernourished, and I realized that my father was heading for Ratner's on the Lower East Side, where we were all going to be eating vegetarian chopped liver together. and I wanted to die, you know, but at the same time, I had this just indescribable thrill and joy and feeling of triumph. At the same time, I wanted to just disappear.
Well, you know, I don't know if you ever feel this way, but sometimes you're one way around one group of people and a slightly different way around another.
Right,
the way
exactly.
One is around one's parents isn't always the way one is around, say, Allen Ginsberg.
No, I would say not.
Yeah, so did you have to figure out who you were going to be during that lunch?
Well, that's what was so horrible. I almost don't remember the lunch because I was, it was actually kind of very, very late dinner, because I really felt like I was going to sort of pass out with kind of quandariness about who and what I should be. What I didn't realize at the time, you know, was that Allen was very much like me. I mean, he loved his father. His father also drove him crazy, his father Lewis, and he adored his stepmother. And one of the first things he did when he sold his papers and finally had a lot of money at the end of his life is he set his stepmother up in a kind of beautiful apartment. You know, it's exactly the kind of thing I would have done if a college wanted my papers and gave me $1 million. So in a way, we were very much alike, but we were just both too, I think, shy and embarrassed to admit it.
Sam Cashner, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Sam Cashner speaking to Terry Gross in 2004. Cashner studied with beat poets Allen Ginsberg, Gregory Corso, and William Burroughs. His memoir about that often surrealistic learning experience, called When I Was Cool, has just been released in paperback. We'll end this half of the show with Allen Ginsberg reading from his poem, A Supermarket in California, recorded in 1956. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
What thoughts I have of you tonight, Walt Whitman. For I walk down the side streets under the trees with a headache, self-conscious, looking at the full moon. In my hungry fatigue and shopping for images, I went into the neon fruit supermarket, dreaming of your enumeration. What peaches and what penumbras? Whole families shopping at night. Aisles full of husbands, wives in the avocados, babies in the tomatoes, and you, Garcia Lorca, what were you doing down by the watermelon? I saw you, Walt Whitman, childless, lonely old grubber, poking among the meats in the refrigerator and eyeing the grocery boys. I heard you asking questions of each. Who killed the pork chops? What price bananas? Are you my angel? I wandered in and out of the brilliant stacks of cans, following you and followed in my imagination by the store detective. We strode down the open corridors together in our solitary fancy, tasting artichokes, possessing every frozen delicacy and never passing the cashier. Which way are we going, Walt Whitman? The doors close in an hour. Which way does your beard point tonight? I touch your book.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations. From Barnes & Noble, publisher of Selecting the Pope, Uncovering the Mysteries of Papal Elections by Greg Tobin. Available in stores and online at bn.com. And from Bantam Books, publisher of Dialogues by Stephen Spignesi.
Coming up, Ruth Reichel tells us how she got away with it. For years, she took on different identities to conceal the fact that she was the food critic for the New York Times. Her new book is Garlic and Sapphires, The Secret Life of a Critic in Disguise. Also, a review of the new French film Kings and Queen. David Edelstein tells us why he loves it. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Ruth Reichel knows a lot about food, how to prepare it, how to savor it, and how to write about it. She's the former restaurant critic for the New York Times and the LA Times, and she's been editor-in-chief of Gourmet magazine since 1999. She's just written her third gastronomic memoir, Garlic and Sapphires, about what it's like to have maybe the best job in the world. Many restaurant critics disguise themselves when they're dining out, but Reichel went so far as to create alter egos with their own names, personalities, and elaborate get-ups. Terry Gross spoke with Reichel last October.
Now, before going to Gourmet, you were a restaurant critic for the New York Times, and one of the things that you were famous for was wearing disguises, using aliases on your credit cards so that people wouldn't know who you were and that you wouldn't be given special treatment and specially prepared food, special tables, and therefore you could assess what the restaurant was really like, not what it was like when they were trying to please you because you were the restaurant critic for the Times. So how is the dining out experience different for you now? You are still in the food writing business. You're just not reviewing restaurants for the Times. So are you still using any kind of disguises or
No, the disguises are over. And it's very different now. I mean, I go out and most of the time use my own name. And I sort of figure after 30 years of, you know, being the people's spy, being completely anonymous, always getting the worst table in the room, it's really nice to go out and get a good table, not have to wait for my table. Although I have to say that my husband, who really does not like all the falderol, really prefers it if we just go anonymously. So I would say about half the time we still make them in somebody else, whoever's name we're going with, and just, you know, try and be ordinary people.
When you were using disguises, wigs, I guess funny glasses probably too.
Well, you know, I have a book coming out in April.
What you're going to talk about?
About the disguises. I mean, it's literally each chapter is in the voice of another disguise. I mean, I had real people who I became, and the disguises were very elaborate, and it was. It was an amazing experience to feel what it was like to be an old lady. My probably most effective disguise was as a sort of very nondescript old woman who was never treated very well. And then I also had I thought she was pretty sexy anyway, blonde woman. And that, for someone who I am not blonde or sexy. And it was amazing to discover my inner blonde with Chloe.
Chloe, perfect.
Yes.
What was the older woman called?
The older woman was Betty Jones.
Oh, Betty Jones,
she was
okay.
Known, and she went out with groups of people, and she was known as Aunt Betty. And everybody referred to her as Aunt Betty. And Aunt Betty had, you know, really... I found her on a bus. I saw a woman. I got up once on a bus to give my seat to an older woman. And she looked at me and she said, "Are you really giving me your seat?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Oh, no one ever stands up for me. Sometimes I feel invisible." And I thought, that's what I want. I want to be invisible. So I actually followed her home. And her name, you know, looked at her name on her mailbox, and she was Betty Jones. And I turned myself into Betty Jones, and it was an amazing experience.
Where did you go shopping to be her?
I went to thrift stores, and I actually found a pair of Energetic shoes. Do you remember Energetics? They were those sort of lace-up Oxfords with the little holes in them, and I found a pair that fit me perfectly. And I would wear layers and layers of clothes, so I got much larger without having to have pillows on under me. And she really, nobody saw her.
But I'll tell you,
nobody saw her.
You can't be, you know, Aunt Betty and go to Le Cirque, because Aunt Betty isn't going to be able to afford Le Cirque. She's unlikely to be there. So you were probably only able to be her in certain restaurants that you were reviewing.
Right, but I could be Aunt Betty in a group of people at Le Cirque, where I could take other people
And you'd be
disappear.
Their Aunt Betty.
Uh-huh, I'd be their Aunt Betty, and I might not be appropriate there, but you get lost in a crowd, and she would just disappear. So we would all be anonymous, and I would get to see what happened. But certainly Aunt Betty alone in a restaurant was pretty conspicuous.
I confess, there are certain things that really bug me about certain restaurants that I see as really pretentious. But I'm wondering, when you were in the guise of Aunt Betty, if there were certain aspects of the more high-end restaurants that seemed particularly snobbish or pretentious to you.
The most difficult experience I had in a restaurant as Aunt Betty was I went by myself once alone to a pretty fancy restaurant as Aunt Betty just for lunch to check on something. I was writing the review and I suddenly realized that I had only had this dish once and I thought, to be fair, I needed to have it a second time. So I became Aunt Betty, went there for lunch, and the maitre d' was very nice, but it was the response of these rich women in the restaurant not wanting to sit near me that really offended me. The maitre d' started bringing this bejeweled woman, and she sort of glanced at me and said, I'd like another seat. And I found that deeply offensive. I mean, much more offensive than anything any restaurant ever did.
Do you like coffee shops? And I'm talking about, there's a certain type of New York coffee shop where it's not, like, the coffee's probably really terrible there, but they have, you know, they have your basic, like, omelets and chicken and fish dishes that are prepared, nothing special, but they're really cheap, they're perfectly serviceable, they're fast. I mean, I just love places like that.
And not only that, if you go there a few times, they know you, and you walk in, you sit down at the counter, and they instantly know that what you want is a corn muffin toasted and a cup of coffee with no sugar in it.
Exactly.
And it just, it slides in front. What I love about those places is I love the daily ritual of it. I love that becoming part of a community. I mean, for me, that's one of the things that's so great about restaurants is that it is a way for you to have a life outside of your ordinary life where you are known, but you're known in just that small corner. And it's very comforting to go in on a regular basis and have that sort of 3 or 4 time a week conversation with someone and to feel like you're recognized. And, you know, I mean, for people like the Betty Joneses of the world who live alone, it's something really wonderful that kind of restaurant, it's a purpose that it serves.
Well, you know, when you were Betty Jones, you would sometimes go alone to a restaurant. I don't know if you do that in your other disguises as well, or if you do that as yourself, as Ruth Reichel. How do you feel about dining alone in a restaurant? Some people are very comfortable doing that. Some people feel incredibly self-conscious. For some people, it makes them feel incredibly lonely, and they think that other people will be staring at them, feeling sorry for them.
Well, I did it. I almost always went to the restaurants that I was reviewing at least once alone because I like to eavesdrop on people, and it's very hard to do that when you're with a group of people. So I would always go alone just to sort of try and soak up the atmosphere of the restaurant and just to sit there and, you know, focus on what people around me were saying and what they were doing. I have to say that I'm not self-conscious about it. But for me, eating is a social act. And it's not a great pleasure to me to eat alone. You know, I would do it for work, but given my druthers, I would really rather eat bad food in a congenial group of people than great food by myself.
So you're not the kind of person who'll go and prop up your newspaper on the ketchup bottle and enjoy dining out alone.
No, I mean, as I said, it's a great way to sort of soak up the atmosphere.
I've done that a lot. But,
no, I'm more likely to go home and eat a bowl of cereal if I'm by myself.
Right.
I mean, I love the social interaction of eating. And for me, you know, the great joy of cooking, of preparing a meal is that you're gathering people you care about, interesting people around a table, and you're facilitating the conversation. You know, one of the things that good food does in a relaxed atmosphere is it just makes what happens at a table that much more pleasurable and that much more interesting. And, you know, for me, that's what cooking is about.
You want to tell us about another one of your New York Times reviewer characters?
Sure. Well, my favorite was Brenda. Brenda was a big, boisterous redhead, very messy red hair, long, slightly bohemian, and she made people smile. Everybody smiled at her. And I just felt like Brenda's world was a nicer place than my world. Just everybody talked to her. Waiters loved her, brought her extra food. Even in very fancy restaurants. One of my great experiences was going with a group of friends as Brenda and having this quite starchy woman at the next table lean over and say, you know, it looks to me like you don't come to restaurants like this very often. And then getting incredibly embarrassed because she'd realized what she'd said. And Brenda said, no, no, thank you. That's true. We don't. And she said, well, I just want to make sure you don't miss the great food at this restaurant and be sure that you order this and this and this. And, you know, Brenda was a great pleasure. And, you know, so much so that it scared me a little. My family liked her better than they liked me.
Were you ever in theater?
No, but this was, when I started doing the disguises, my mother had a friend who was a theatrical coach, and she helped me. With the first disguise, she said, you really need to, you need to inhabit this. You can't just put on a wig. That's not going to work. If you're going to do this right. You're the restaurant critic of the New York Times, and you can't be a fool. So she made me, for my first review, which was the review of Le Cirque, she made me really do the whole backstory for the person that I was becoming, who was a very middle-aged Midwestern, very unexceptional woman. But she made me know everything about her. And she came with me to the first meal, and I really did find myself becoming that person. It was a little spooky, but very fun.
Did you have voices for them?
I did. It wasn't conscious. And I can't do them unless I'm them. You know, I mean, it's just now I can't do them. I'm a little worried because I'm going to have to read the book, and I'm afraid that I'm going to have to get in, and I don't have the disguises anymore, because when I left the Times, we auctioned them off for charity, and I don't have them anymore, and I don't know how I'm going to do the voices.
Ruth Reichel speaking to Terry Gross. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with author and food critic Ruth Reichel. Her newest book, Garlic and Sapphires, has just been published.
Ruth, the last time we spoke was when your memoir, Tender at the Bone, was published. And in that, you wrote a little bit about your mother, who you described as being food blind in the way that some people are colorblind, and
right.
That she would like serve food that had turned bad and wouldn't be able to tell the difference. And I was trying to remember, was your mother mentally ill? Was this a symptom of a larger problem?
Yeah, she had what's now called bipolar disorder, which in those days was called manic depression. And we didn't know it for a long time. And then in the beginning of the 60s, when the first people who were working with, you know, psychopharmacology, my mother went to see one of those doctors. And for her, it was just a huge relief to know that it wasn't her fault. You know, she'd been in analysis and it was all about, this is your fault. And, you know, she said that, you know, being told that there were drugs that you could take for it was just, you know, just huge. A huge, huge relief. In the book, I initially tried to make her a comic character. And when it didn't work, I sort of just came clean and said, you know, she did have this illness.
Were there different foods that she'd make depending on whether she was in a manic or depressive period?
Well, when she was depressed, she just went to bed. She'd go to bed for months on end and literally read the same book over and over and over again. And I mean, one of the reasons, and I didn't put this into the book, but one of the reasons that I started cooking so early was that Mom would just, you know, you'd come home from school and she would not have gotten out of bed all day. And so the cooking really did fall to me. I didn't think that was something that you put in the book. But when she was manic, she was really when she did. I mean, I describe in the beginning of that book, I describe a party she gave for my brother's engagement when she put 26 people in the hospital with food poisoning. And that was at her absolute most manic. When, you know, she went to Horn and Hardart and came home with a car filled with little tiny boxes of food that they had been selling as seconds and mixed it all together in this disgusting mush. And that was, you know, that was about as manic as you can get.
Are there foods that you developed a revulsion to because of something that your mother served, not realizing that it had gone bad or that it just simply tasted terrible?
Oddly, no. You know, what my mother's illness did for me was make me very acutely aware of food, make me very conscious of tasting it to see, is this good or is this not good, really honed my taste buds. I mean, I think made me really focus on flavor and describing it to myself. I think made me into a food writer. And for whatever reasons, because I'm genetically predisposed to love food and love cooking and love eating or whatever, there's almost nothing that I don't like. And even some of the foods that my mother made most miserable, I still love.
You have a son who I believe is about 14. Is that right?
He's 15, yes.
Okay. How has being a mother changed you as a cook? Because, let's face it, children's tastes and adults' tastes and foods are pretty different. And so you had to learn to cook for a child in addition to cooking for you and your husband.
I have to say the one thing that I feel as a mother is the most important thing, and it's why I ultimately stopped being a restaurant critic and took a job where I could be home cooking dinner every night, is that I think the most important thing you can do for your children is sit down to dinner together. We have breakfast and dinner every day with my family, and I don't think it matters what you put on the table or how you get that food on the table. I don't think it matters whether you cook it yourself or you order in, but I do think it's important to sit down and eat dinner with your children. And so I have tried to cook foods that Nick will like, but I think the notion that children have different tastes is sort of silly. You know, children in Vietnam eat different foods than children in France and children in the United States. And children eat what they are given. They aren't born with tastes. And I've never forced Nick to eat anything. You know, we'll cook things that he likes, but he started out as a kid who ate five white foods. And as a 15-year-old, he's an omnivore. He will eat anything. And I think it's partly because he just saw that we loved food.
Ruth Reichel, thank you so much for talking with us.
This has been a pleasure.
Ruth Reichel, speaking to Terry Gross. Her new book, Garlic and Sapphires, is subtitled The Secret Life of a Critic in Disguise. She's the editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine and has worked as a restaurant critic on both coasts for the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews the new French film, Kings and Queen. This is Fresh Air. Kings and Queen is the sixth film by the 44-year-old French director Arnaud Desplechin, whose work was the focus of a recent retrospective at New York's Brooklyn Academy of Music. He said he wanted to make a film in which a somber strand and a comic strand were woven together to create something larger than each. And the result, Kings and Queen, has won near-universal acclaim. It opens today in New York and Los Angeles and goes wider next month. David Edelstein has this review.
Most films come with signposts. They signal what you're going to see before you see it, in ways you often don't even register. But the great dramatists create their own syntax. Take Arnaud Desplechin, one of France's least heralded master directors. He varies tones, rhythms, and styles to underline his character's emotions, and you're always one step behind, racing to catch up and make psychological sense of them. His work is nervy and glancing and intuitive, and so are his extraordinary actors. I find Desplechin's storytelling fascinating, which is why I love his new film, Kings and Queen, even though I don't feel as if I fully penetrated its mysteries. No, this isn't The Emperor's New Clothes. I know it's there. If nothing else, it holds you on the basic level of a good soap opera. It's just that Desplechin's vision of two people trying to understand their place in the universe seems too complex and contradictory to reduce. Even as they psychoanalyze themselves, they're elusive. Their motives are just beyond your grasp, and beyond their own grasp, too. Set mostly in Grenoble, in the present, Kings and Queen has two storylines that intersect about halfway through its 2.5-hour running time. Nora, played by Emmanuel Davos, is a widow, mother, and devoted daughter to her father Louis, a renowned author and published diarist, played by Maurice Garrel. At the start, Nora talks to the camera. She tells the story of Zeus, who took the form of a swan and made love to Leda. What does this mean? A clue is that she buys an illustration of the myth as a gift for her father, who's clearly uncomfortable with it. He's uncomfortable for another reason. His insides are ravaged by a cancer that will kill him in days. His illness impels Nora to find a place for her 11-year-old, Elias, to stay, so she can take care of her dad, and then, in one of those inexplicable psychological turns, a place for him to stay permanently, maybe with her last lover, Ismail, whom he adored. Played by Desplechin regular Mathieu Amalric, Ismail is the movie's second protagonist. In his first scene, two smiling men in white haul him from his chaotic apartment to a mental hospital. A respected violist, he's antic and grandiose and unhinged, but he's hugely likable. Now we see the protagonists struggle. Nora to watch her father die, Ismail to center himself, despite his lawyer showing up to steal drugs from the hospital pharmacy, a nurse therapist who flirts with him madly because he is a cutie, and a suicidal patient who thinks he's her soulmate. Ismail has two therapists, a hospital one, played by the still stunningly beautiful Catherine Deneuve, the other, an immense French-African woman, played by Elsa Wollaston, with whom he grapples with the meaning of existence. Nora and Ismail try to use myths to explain their lives, but we learn, to our shock, that they haven't begun to put it all together, and neither have we. Desplechin serves up dreams, visions, horrifying flashbacks, scenes set against theatrical backdrops with melodramatic music, and opening and closing snatches of the song Moon River, which poses the question, is Nora a modern Holly-Golightly instead of a modern Leda? The final act contains a series of climactic exchanges between Ismail and his former musical partner, between Nora and her father via his last diary entry, and between Ismail and the boy Elias, and they hit you like an anvil and make you question everything you've thought about these people. I came to dislike the two protagonists for their selfishness, but then one of Desplechin's implicit messages is that humans are blinkered and self-centered. The movie ends with Nora's son assembling a collage featuring heads of all the figures in his life. Like us, he's trying to puzzle it out. We're used to movies that are intellectual jigsaw puzzles, but not emotional ones that make us question everything we thought we understood, in the characters' lives and by extension in our own. I'm still working on the jigsaw puzzle that is Kings and Queen. and I'm thoroughly engrossed.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. The great arranger and conductor Gil Evans was born 93 years ago today. We'll close with the 1957 Miles Davis recording, Miles Ahead, from the album of the same name, the first full-length collaboration between Davis and Evans. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation with a mandate from Andrew Carnegie to promote the advancement and diffusion of knowledge and understanding. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, husband and wife actors Felicity Huffman and William H. Macy. They've collaborated on a new offbeat independent film called Transamerica, about a transsexual woman who meets the son she never knew she fathered. Join us for the next Fresh Air.